sound of the waves, though, he suddenly perceived other sounds. Boats. The grating of hulls, more than one, on gravel. The clank of oarlocks splashing. And voices. Hushed voices, but agitated. Bloody hell. He ducked under the limb of a runty pine, hoping for a break in the drifting fog. A sudden movement sent him lunging sideways, hand reaching for his pistol. He barely remembered that the pistol was gone before realizing that his adversary was a great blue heron, which eyed him with a yellow glare before launching itself skyward in a clatter of affront. A cry of alarm came from the bushes no more than 10 feet away, together with the boom of a musket, and the heron exploded in a shower of feathers directly over his head. He felt drops of the bird's blood, much warmer than the cold sweat on his face, and sat down very suddenly, black spots dizzy before his eyes. He didn't dare move, let alone call out. There was a whisper of voices from the bushes, but not loud enough that he could make out any words. After a few moments, though, he heard a stealthy rustling that moved gradually away. Making as little noise as possible, he rolled onto hands and knees and crawled for some distance in the other direction until he felt it safe to rise to his feet again. He thought he still heard voices. He crept closer, moving slowly, his heart thumping. He smelled tobacco and froze. Nothing moved near him, though. He could still hear the voices, but they were a good way distant. He sniffed cautiously, but the scent had vanished. Perhaps he was imagining things. He moved on toward the sounds. He could hear them clearly now. Urgent, low-voiced calls, the rattle of oarlocks, and the splash of feet in the surf. The shuffle and murmur of men blending almost with the susurrus of sea and grass. He cast one last desperate glance at the sky, but the sun was still invisible. He had to be on the western side of the island, he was sure of it. Almost sure of it. And if he was... If he was, the sounds he was hearing had to be those of American troops fleeing the island for Manhattan. Don't stir. The whisper behind him coincided exactly with the pressure of a gun's barrel jammed hard enough into his kidney as to freeze him where he stood. It withdrew for an instant and returned, rammed home with a force that blurred his eyes. He made a guttural sound and arched his back, but before he could speak, someone with horny hands had seized his wrists and jerked them back. No need, said the voice, deep, cracked and querulous. Stand aside and I'll shoot him. No, he won't, said another, just as deep but less annoyed. He's no but a young'un. And pretty, too. One of the horny hands stroked his cheek and he stiffened, but whoever it was had already bound his hands tight. And if he meant to shoot him, you'd have done it already, sister, the voice added. Turn yourself, boy. Slowly he turned round to see that he'd been captured by a pair of old women, short and squat as trolls. One of them, the one with the gun, was smoking a pipe. It was her tobacco he'd smelled. Seeing the shock and disgust on his features, she lifted one corner of a seamed mouth while keeping a firm grip on the pipe stem with the stumps of brown-stained teeth. "Handsome is as handsome does," she observed, looking him up and down. "Still, no need to waste shot." "Madam," he said, collecting himself and trying for charm, "I believe you mistake me. I am a soldier of the king, and..." Both of them burst into laughter, creaking like a pair of rusty hinges.
"Wouldn't never have guessed," the pipe smoker said, grinning round the stem of her pipe. "Thought he was a gentleman, sure."
"Hush up, sonny,"
her sister interrupted his further attempt to speak.
"We bain't going to army so long as he stands still and keeps mum."
She eyed him, taking in the damage.
"Been in the wars, have he?"
she said, not without sympathy. Not waiting for an answer, she pushed him down onto a rock, this liberally crusted with mussels and dripping weed, from which he deduced his closeness to the shore. didn't speak, not for fear of the old women, but because there was nothing to say. He sat, listening to the sounds of the exodus. No idea how many men might be involved, as he had no notion of how long it had been going on. Nothing useful was said. There were only the breathless, half-heard exchanges of men working, the mutter of waiting, here and there the sort of muffled laughter born of nervousness. The fog was lifting off the water. He could see them now, not more than 100 yards away. A tiny fleet of rowboats, dories, here and there a fishing catch, moving slowly to and fro across water smooth as glass. And a steadily dwindling crowd of men on shore, keeping their hands on their guns, glancing continually over their shoulders, alert for pursuit. Little did they know, he reflected bitterly. At the moment, he had no concern for his own future. The humiliation of being an impotent witness as the entire American army escaped under his nose, and the further thought of being obliged to return and recount this occurrence to General Howe was so galling that he didn't care whether the old woman had it in mind to cook and eat him. Focused as he was on the scene on the beach, it didn't occur to him at once that if he could now see the Americans, he was himself visible to them. In fact, so intent were the Continentals and militia men on their retreat that none of them did notice him, until one man turned away from the retreat, seeming to search the upper reaches of the shore for something. The man stiffened, then, with a brief glance back at his oblivious companions, came purposefully up across the shingle, eyes fixed on William.
"What's this, mother?" he asked.
He was dressed in the uniform of a Continental officer, built short and wide, much like the two women, but a good deal bigger, and while his face was outwardly calm, there were calculations going on behind his bloodshot eyes.
"Been fishing," said the pipe smoker. "Caught this wee redfish, but we think we'll throw him back." "Aye, maybe not just yet."
William had stiffened with the man's appearance and stared up at him, keeping his own face as grim as possible. The man glanced up at the shredding fog behind William.
"More like you at home, are there, boy?"
William sat silent. The man sighed, drew back his fist, and hit William in the stomach. He doubled up, fell off the rock, and lay retching on the sand. The man grasped him by the collar and hauled him up as though he weighed nothing.
"Answer me, lad. I haven't much time, and he don't want me to be hasty in my asking."
He spoke mildly, but touched the knife at his belt. William wiped his mouth as well as he could on his shoulder and faced the man, eyes burning.
"All right," he thought,
and felt a certain calmness descend on him.
"If this is where I die, at least I'll die for something."
The thought was almost a relief. The pipe smoker's sister put paid to the dramatics, though, poking his interrogator in the ribs with her musket.
"If there was more, sister and I had heard 'em long since," she said, mildly disgusted. "They ain't quiet, sodgers." "True that," the pipe smoker agreed, and paused to remove her pipe long enough to spit. "This un's only lost. He can see as much. He can see he won't talk to he either."
She grinned familiarly at William, displaying one remaining yellow dog tooth.
"Rather die than speak, eh, lad?"
William inclined his head a stiff inch, and the women giggled. No other word for it. They giggled at him.
"Get on with thee,"
Aunt told the man, waving a hand at the beach behind him.
"They'll leave without thee."
The man didn't look at her, didn't take his eyes off William's. After a moment, though, he nodded briefly and turned on his heel. William felt one of the women behind him. Something sharp touched his wrist, and the twine they'd bound him with parted. He wanted to rub his wrists, but didn't.
"Go, boy," the pipe smoker said almost gently, "before someone else sees thee and gets ideas."
He left. At the top of the beach, he paused and looked back. The old women had vanished, But the man was sitting in the stern of a rowboat, drawing rapidly away from the shore, now nearly empty. The man was staring at him. William turned away. The sun was finally visible, a pale orange circle burning through the haze. It was coming down the sky now, early afternoon. He turned inland and struck southwest, but felt eyes on his back for a long time after the shore had fallen out of sight behind him. His stomach was sore, and the only thought in his mind was what Captain Ramsay had said to him.
Heard of a lady called Cassandra?
Chapter 7. An Uncertain Future. Lallybroch, Inverness-shire, September 1980. Not all of the letters were dated, but some were. Bree sorted gingerly through the half-dozen on top, and with a sense of being poised at the top of a roller coaster, chose one with 2nd March AD 1777 written across the flap.
I think this one's next. She had trouble taking a full breath. It's thin, short.
It was. No more than a page and a half, but the reason for its brevity was clear. Her father had written the whole of it. His awkward, determined writing wrung her heart.
We are never letting a teacher try to make Jemmy write with his right hand, she said fiercely to Roger. Never. Right, he said, surprised and a little amused at her outburst. Or left, if you prefer.
March the 2nd, Anno Domini, 1777. Fraser's Ridge, Colony of North Carolina.
My dearest daughter, we prepare now to remove to Scotland, not forever or even for long. My life, our lives, live here in America, and in all honesty I should greatly prefer to be stung to death by hornets than set foot on board another ship. I try not to dwell upon the prospect, but there are two chief concerns which compel me to this decision. Had I not the gift of knowledge that you and your mother and Roger Mack have brought me, I would likely think, as the great majority of people in the colony do think, that the Continental Congress will not last 6 months, and Washington's army less than that. I have spoken myself with a man from Cross Creek who was discharged honourably from the Continental Army on account of a festering wound in the arm. Your mother has, of course, dealt with this. He screamed a great deal, and I was pressed into service to sit upon him. Who tells me that Washington has no more than a few thousand regular soldiers, all very poor in equipment, clothes and arms, and all old money, which they are unlikely to receive. Most of his men are militia, enlisted on short contracts of 2 or 3 months, and already melting away, needing to return home for the planting. But I do know. At the same time, I cannot be sure how things that I know will come about. Am I meant to be in some way part of this? Should I hold back, will that somehow damage or prevent the success of our desires? I often wish I could discuss these questions with your husband, though Presbyterian that he is, I think he would find them even more unsettling than I do. And in the end, it does not matter. I am what God has made me, and must deal with the times in which he has placed me. While I have not yet lost the faculties of sight or hearing, nor even control of my bowels, I am not a young man. I have a sword and a rifle and can use them both. But I also have a printing press and can use that to much greater effect. It does not escape me that one can wield sword or musket only upon one enemy at a time, while words may be employed upon any number. Your mother, doubtless contemplating the prospect of my being seasick for several weeks in her immediate vicinity, suggests that I might enter business with Fergus, making use of Longyong's press, rather than travel to Scotland to retrieve my own. I considered this, but I cannot in conscience expose Fergus and his family to danger by making use of their press for such purposes as I intend.
Theirs is one of only a few presses in operation between Charleston and Norfolk. Even were I to do my printing with the utmost secrecy, suspicion would focus upon them in short order. New Bern is a hotbed of loyalist sentiment, and the origins of my pamphleteering would become known almost immediately. Beyond consideration for Fergus and his family, I think there may be some benefit in visiting Edinburgh in order to retrieve my own press. I had a varied acquaintance there. Some may have escaped prison or the noose. The second and most important consideration that compels me to Scotland, though, is your cousin Ian. Years ago I swore to his mother, upon the memory of our own mother, that I would bring him home to her, and this I mean to do, though the man I bring back to Lallybroch is not the lad who left there. God alone knows what they will make of each other, Ian and Lallybroch, and God has a most peculiar sense of humour. But if he is to go back at all, it must be now. The snow is melting, water drips from the eaves all day, and icicles reach from the roof of the cabin nearly to the ground by morning. Within a few weeks the roads will be clear enough for travel. It seems strange to ask that you pray for the safety of a voyage which will have been long completed by the time you learn of it, for good or ill. But I ask it, nonetheless. Tell Roger Mack that I think God takes no account of time. And kiss the children for me. Your most affectionate father, J.F. Roger sat back a little, eyebrows raised, and glanced at her.
The French connection, you think?
The what? She frowned over his shoulder, saw where his finger marked the text. Where he's talking about his friends in Edinburgh?
Aye, but not a good many of his Edinburgh acquaintances, smugglers.
That's what Mama said.
Hence the remark about nooses. And where were they smuggling things from, mostly?
Her stomach gave a small hop.
Oh, you're kidding.
You think he's planning to mess with French smugglers?
Well, not smugglers necessarily. He apparently knew a good many seditionists, thieves and prostitutes, too.
Roger smiled briefly, but then grew serious again.
But I told him as much as I knew about the shape of the revolution. Admittedly, not a lot of detail, it not being my period. And I certainly told him how important France would be to the Americans. I'm just thinking.
He paused a little awkwardly, then looked up at her.
He isn't going to Scotland to avoid the fighting. He's pretty clear about that.
So you think he might be looking for political connections? She asked slowly. Not just grabbing his printing press, dropping Ian off at Lallybroch, and beating it back to America. She found the idea something of a relief. The notion of her parents intriguing in Edinburgh and Paris was much less hair-raising than her visions of them in the midst of explosions and battlefields. And it would be both of them, she realised. Where her father went, her mother would be too. Roger shrugged.
That offhand remark about being what God made him. You ken what he means by that.
A bloody man, she said softly, and moved closer to Roger, putting a hand on his shoulder as though to ensure that he wouldn't suddenly vanish. He told me he was a bloody man, that he'd seldom choose to fight, but knew he was born to do it.
Aye, that,
Roger said just as softly.
But he's no longer the young laird who took up his sword and led 30 crofters to a doomed battle, and took them home again. He knows a lot more now about what one man can do. I think he means to do it.
I think so, too. Her throat felt tight, but as much with pride as fear. Roger reached up and put his hand over hers, squeezing.
I remember, he said slowly, a thing your mother said, telling us about when she came back and how she became a doctor. A thing you're... Frank, that he said to her. something about it being bloody inconvenient to the people round her, but a great blessing that she knew what it was she was meant to be. He was right about that, I think. And Jamie does know.
She nodded. She probably shouldn't say it, she thought, but she couldn't hold the words back any longer.
Do you know?
He was silent for a long time, looking at the pages on the table, but at last shook his head, the motion so small that she felt rather than saw it.
I used to,
he said quietly, and let go of her hand.
Her first impulse was to punch him in the back of the neck. Her second was to seize him by the shoulders, bend down with her eyeballs an inch from his, and say calmly but distinctly, "What the hell do you mean by that?" She refrained from doing either, only because both were likely to lead to a prolonged conversation of a sort deeply inappropriate for children, and both the kids were in the hall a few feet from the study door. She could hear them talking.
"See that?"
Jemmy was saying.
"Uh-huh. Bad people came here a long time ago looking for Granda. Bad English people. They did that."
Roger's head turned as he caught what Jemmy was saying, and he caught Brianna's eye with a half-smile.
"Bad English," Mandy repeated obligingly. "Make 'em clean it up."
In spite of her annoyance, Brianna couldn't help sharing Roger's smile, though she felt a small shimmer in the pit of her stomach, recalling her Uncle Ian, so calm, so kind a man, showing her the sabre slashes in the wooden panelling of the hall and telling her, "We keep it so to shew the children, and tell them this is what the English are." There had been steel in his voice, and hearing a faint, absurdly childish echo of it in Jemmy's voice, she had her first doubts regarding the wisdom of keeping this particular family tradition.
"Did you tell him about it?" she asked Roger as the children's voices moved away toward the kitchen.
"I didn't."
"Annie told him part of it. I thought I'd best tell him the rest."
He raised his eyebrows.
"Should I have told him to ask you?"
"Oh, no. No," she repeated dubiously. "Should we be teaching him to hate English people?"
Roger smiled at that.
"Hate might be pitching it a bit strong. And he did say bad English people. They were bad English people who did that. Besides, if he's going to grow up in the Highlands, he'll likely hear a few barbed remarks regarding Sassenachs. He'll balance those against his memories of your mother. Your da always called her Sassenach, after all."
He glanced at the letter on the table, caught a glimpse of the wall clock, and rose abruptly.
"Christ, I'm late. I'll stop at the bank whilst I'm in town. Need anything from the farm and household?"
"Yes," she said dryly, "a new pump for the milk separator."
"Right,"
he said, and kissing her hastily, went out, one arm already into his jacket.
She opened her mouth to call after him that she'd been joking, but on second thought, closed it. The farm and household just might have a pump for a milk separator. A large, bewilderingly crowded building on the edge of Inverness, the farm and household supplied just about anything a farm might need, including pitchforks, rubber fire buckets, baling wire, and washing machines, as well as crockery, jars for canning, and not a few mysterious implements whose use she could only guess at. She stuck her head into the corridor, but the kids were in the kitchen with Annie MacDonald, the hired girl. Laughter and the wired clong of the ancient toaster, it had come with the house, floated past the ratty green baize door, along with the enticing scent of hot buttered toast. The smell and the laughter drew her like a magnet, and the warmth of home flowed over her, golden as honey. She paused to fold up the letter, though, before going to join them, and the memory of Roger's last remark tightened her mouth.
"I used to."
Snorting ferociously, she tucked the letter back into the box and went out into the hall, only to be arrested by sight of a large envelope on the table near the door, where the Daily Mail and the contents of Roger's and Jemmy's pockets were daily unloaded. She grabbed the envelope out of the pile of circulars, pebbles, pencil stubs, links of bicycle chain and... Was that a dead mouse? It was, flattened and dried, but adorned with a stiff loop of pink tail. She picked it up gingerly, and with the envelope clasped against her breast, made her way toward tea and toast. In all honesty, she thought, Roger wasn't the only one keeping things to himself. The difference was, she planned to tell him what she was thinking, once it was settled. Chapter 8. Spring Thaw. Fraser's Ridge, Colony of North Carolina, March 1777. One thing about a devastating fire, I reflected, it did make packing easier. At present, I owned one gown, one shift, three petticoats, one woolen, two muslin, two pairs of stockings. I'd been wearing one pair when the house burned, the other had been carelessly left drying on a bush a few weeks before the fire, and was discovered later, weathered but still wearable, a shawl and a pair of shoes. Jamie had procured a horrible cloak for me somewhere. I didn't know where and didn't want to ask. Made of thick wool the colour of leprosy, it smelled as though someone had died in it and lain undiscovered for a couple of days. I'd boiled it with lye soap, but the ghost of its previous occupant lingered. Still, I wouldn't freeze. My medical kit was nearly as simple to pack. With a regretful sigh for the ashes of my beautiful apothecary's chest, with its elegant tools and numerous bottles, I turned over the pile of salvage remnants from my surgery. The dented barrel of my microscope, three singed ceramic jars, one missing its lid, one cracked. A large tin of goose grease mixed with camphor, now nearly empty after a winter of catarrhs and coughs. A handful of singed pages ripped from the casebook started by Daniel Rawlings and continued by myself, though my spirits were lifted a bit by the discovery that the salvaged pages included one bearing Dr. Rawlings' special receipt for bowel bind. It was the only one of his receipts I'd found effective, and while I'd long since committed the actual formula to memory, having it to hand kept my sense of him alive. I'd never met Daniel Rawlings in life, but he'd been my friend since the day Jamie gave me his chest and casebook. I folded the paper carefully and tucked it into my pocket. Most of my herbs and compounded medications had perished in the flames, along with the earthenware jars, the glass vials, the large bowls in which I incubated penicillin broth, and my surgical saws. I still had one scalpel and the darkened blade of a small amputation saw. The handle had been charred, but Jamie could make me a new one. The residents of the ridge had been generous as people who had virtually nothing themselves could be at the tail end of winter. We had food for the journey, and many of the women had brought me bits of their household simples. I had small jars of lavender, rosemary, comfrey, and mustard seed, two precious steel needles, a small skein of silk thread to use for sutures and dental floss, though I didn't mention that last use to the ladies, who would have been deeply affronted by the notion, and a very small stock of bandages and gauze for dressings. One thing I had in abundance, though, was alcohol. The corn crib had been spared from the flames, and so had the still. Since there was more than enough grain for both animals and household, Jamie had thriftily transformed the rest into a very raw but potent liquor, which we would take along to trade for necessary goods along the way. One small cask had been kept for my especial use, though. I'd carefully painted the legend Sauerkraut on the side to discourage theft on the road.
"And what if we should be set upon by illiterate banditti?" Jamie had asked, amused by this.
"Thought of that," I informed him, displaying a small corked bottle full of cloudy liquid. "Eau de Sauerkraut. I'll pour it on the cask at first sight of anyone suspicious."
"I suppose we'd best hope they're not German bandits, then."
"Have you ever met a German bandit?" I asked. With the exception of the occasional drunkard or wife-beater, almost all the Germans we knew were honest,
hard-working and virtuous to a fault. Not all that surprising, given that so many of them had come to the colony as part of a religious movement.
Not as such, he admitted. But you mind the mullahs, eh? And what they did to your friends? They wouldn't have called themselves bandits, but the Tuscarora likely didn't make the same distinction.
That was no more than the truth, and a cold thumb pressed the base of my skull. The mullahs, German neighbours, had had a beloved daughter and her newborn child die of measles, and had blamed the nearby Indians for the infection. Deranged by grief, old Herr Müller had led a party of his sons and sons-in-law to take revenge. And scalps. My viscera still remembered the shock of seeing my friend Nyawenny's white-streaked hair spill out of a bundle into my lap.
Is my hair turning white, do you think? I said abruptly.
He raised his eyebrows, but bent forward and peered at the top of my head, fingering gently through my hair.
There's maybe one hair in 50 that's gone white. One in 25 is silver.
Why?
I suppose I have a little time, then. Nyawenny. I hadn't spoken her name aloud in several years, and found an odd comfort in the speaking, as though it had conjured her.
She told me that I'd come into my full power when my hair turned white.
Now there's a fearsome thought, he said, grinning.
No doubt.
Since it hasn't happened yet, though, I suppose if we stumble into a nest of sauerkraut thieves on the road, I'll have to defend my cask with my scalpel, I said. He gave me a slightly queer look at this, but then laughed and shook his head. His own packing was a little more involved. He and young Ian had removed the gold from the house's foundation the night after Mrs. Bug's funeral, a delicate process preceded by my putting out a large slop basin of stale bread soaked in corn liquor, then calling "Sweet!" at the top of my lungs from the head of the garden path. A moment of silence, and then the white sow emerged from her den, a pale blotch against the smoke-stained rocks of the foundation. I knew exactly what she was, but the sight of that white, rapidly moving form still made the hairs stand up on the back of my neck. It had come on to snow, one of the reasons for Jamie's decision to act at once, and she came through the whirl of big, soft flakes with a velocity that made her seem like the spirit of the storm itself, leading the wind. For an instant, I thought she was going to charge me. I saw her head swing toward me and caught the loud snuff as she took my scent.
But she scented the food as well and swerved away.
An instant later, the ungodly sounds of a pig in ecstasy floated through the hush of the snow, and Jamie and Ian hurried out of the trees to begin their work. It took more than 2 weeks to move the gold. They worked only at night, and only when fresh snow was either falling or about to fall, to cover their tracks. Meantime, they took it in turn to guard the remains of the big house, keeping an eye peeled for any sign of Arch Bug.
"Do you think he still cares about the gold?" I'd asked Jamie in the midst of this endeavour, chafing his hands to get enough heat into them for him to hold his spoon.
He'd come in for breakfast, frozen and exhausted after a long night spent walking round and round the burnt house to keep his blood flowing.
"He's no much else to care about, has he?"
He spoke softly to avoid waking the Higgins family.
"Other than Ian."
I shivered, as much from thought of old Arch living wraith-like in the forest, surviving on the heat of his hatred, as from the cold that had come in with Jamie. He'd let his beard grow for warmth, all the men did in winter on the mountain, and ice glimmered in his whiskers and frosted his brows.
"You look like old man Winter himself," I whispered, bringing him a bowl of hot porridge.
"I feel like it," he replied hoarsely.
He passed the bowl under his nose, inhaling the steam and closing his eyes beatifically.
"Pass the whiskey, aye?"
"You're proposing to pour it on your porridge?
It's got butter and salt on it already."
Nonetheless, I passed him the bottle from its shelf over the hearth.
"Nay, I'm going to thaw my whim enough to eat it. I'm solid from the neck down."
No one had seen hide nor hair of Archbug, not even an errant track in the snow since his appearance at the funeral. He might be denned up for the winter, snug in some refuge. He might have gone away to the Indian villages. He might be dead. And I rather hoped he was, uncharitable as the thought might be. I mentioned this, and Jamie shook his head. The ice in his hair had melted now, and the firelight glimmered like diamonds on the water droplets in his beard.
If he's dead, and we never learn of it, Ian will not have a moment's peace, ever.
Do you want him to be looking over his shoulder at his wedding, afraid of a bullet through his wife's heart as she speaks her vows?
Or wed with a family, fearing each day to leave his house and his bairns, for fear of what he might come back to?
I'm impressed at the scope and morbidity of your imagination.
But you're right.
All right. I don't hope he's dead. Not unless we find his body. But no one did find his body, and the gold was moved, bit by bit, to its new hiding place. That had taken a bit of thought and considerable private discussion between Jamie and Ian. Not the whiskey cave. Very few people knew about that, but some did. Joseph Weems, his daughter Lizzie, and her two husbands. I marvelled, rather, that I'd got to the point where I could think about Lizzie and the Beardsleys without boggling. All knew, of necessity. And Bobby and Amy Higgins would need to be shown its location before we left, as they would be making whiskey themselves in our absence. Archbug had not been told of the cave's location, but very likely knew it. Jamie was adamant that no one should know even of the gold's existence on the ridge, let alone its location.
"Let even a rumour of it get out, and everyone here is in danger," he'd said. "You ken what happened when yon Donner told folk we had jewels here."
I can't, all right. I still woke up in the midst of nightmares, hearing the muffled whoomph of exploding ether fumes, hearing the crash of glass and smashing wood as the raiders wrecked the house. In some of these dreams, I ran fruitlessly to and fro, trying to rescue someone. Who? But met always by locked doors, blank walls, or rooms engulfed in flame. In others, I stood rooted, unable to move a muscle, as fire crawled up the walls, fed with delicate greed on the clothes of bodies at my feet, burst through a corpse's hair, caught in my skirts, and swarmed upward, wrapping my legs in a blazing web. I still felt overpowering sadness and a deep cleansing rage when I looked at the sooty smudge in the clearing that had once been my home. But I always had to go out in the morning after one of these dreams and look at it nonetheless. Walk round the cold ruins and smell the taint of dead ash in order to quench the flames that burned behind my eyes. "Right," I said, and pulled my shawl tighter round me. We were standing by the spring house, looking down on the ruins as we talked, and the chill was seeping into my bones.
"So, where then?"
"The Spaniard's cave," he said,
and I blinked at him. "The what?"
"I'll show you an Ian," he said, grinning at me, "when the snow melts."
Spring had sprung, and the creek was rising. Swelled by melting snow and fed by hundreds of tiny waterfalls that trickled and leapt down the mountain's face, it roared past my feet, exuberant with spray. I could feel it cold on my face and knew that I'd be wet to the knees within minutes, but it didn't matter. The fresh green of arrowhead and pickerel weed rimmed the banks, some plants dragged out of the soil by the rising water and whirled downstream, more hanging on by their roots for dear life, leaves trailing in the racing wash. Dark mats of cress swirled under the water close by the sheltering banks. And fresh greens were what I wanted. My gathering basket was half full of fiddleheads and ramp shoots. A nice big lot of tender new cress, crisp and cold from the stream, would top off the winter's vitamin C deficiency very well. I took off my shoes and stockings, and after a moment's hesitation, took off my gown and shawl as well, and hung them over a tree branch. The air was chilly in the shade of the silver birches that overhung the creek here, and I shivered a bit, but ignored the cold, curdling up my shift before wading into the stream. That cold was harder to ignore. I gasped and nearly dropped the basket, but found my footing among the slippery rocks and made my way toward the nearest mat of tempting dark green. Within seconds, my legs were numb, and I'd lost any sense of cold in the enthusiasm of forager's frenzy and salad hunger. A good deal of our stored food had been saved from the fire, as it was kept in the outbuildings, the spring house, corn crib, and smoking shed. The root cellar had been destroyed, though, and with it, not only the carrots, onions, garlic, and potatoes, but most of my carefully gathered stock of dried apples and wild yams, and the big hanging clusters of raisins, all meant to keep us from the ravages of scurvy. The herbs, of course, had gone up in smoke, along with the rest of my surgery. True, a large quantity of pumpkins and squashes had escaped, these having been piled in the barn. But one grows tired of squash pie and succotash after a couple of months. Well, after a couple of days, speaking personally. Not for the first time I mourned Mrs. Bug's abilities as a cook, though, of course, I did miss her for her own sake. Amy McCullum Higgins had been raised in a crofter's cottage in the Highlands of Scotland, and was, as she put it, a good plain cook. Essentially, that meant she could bake bannocks, boil porridge, and fry fish simultaneously without burning any of it. No mean feat, but a trifle monotonous in terms of diet. My own pièce de résistance was stew, which, lacking onions, garlic, carrots, and potatoes, had devolved into a sort of pottage, consisting of venison or turkey stewed with cracked corn, barley, and possibly chunks of stale bread. Ian, surprisingly, had turned out to be a passable cook. The succotash and squash pie were his contributions to the communal menu. I did wonder who had taught him to make them, but thought it wiser not to ask. So far, no one had starved, nor yet lost any teeth. But by mid-March, I would have been willing to wade neck-deep in freezing torrents in order to acquire something both edible and green. Ian had, thank goodness, gone on breathing, and after a week or so had ceased acting quite so shell-shocked, eventually regaining something like his normal manner. But I noticed Jamie's eyes follow him now and then, and Rollo had taken to sleeping with his head on Ian's chest, a new habit. I wondered whether he really sensed the pain in Ian's heart, or whether it was simply a response to the cramped sleeping conditions in the cabin. I stretched my back, hearing the small pops between my vertebrae. Now that the snowmelt had come, I could hardly wait for our departure. I would miss the ridge and everyone on it. Well, almost everyone. Possibly not Hiram Crombie so much. Or the Chisholms. Or, I short-circuited this list before it became uncharitable. On the other hand, I said firmly to myself, think of beds. Granted, we would be spending a good many nights on the road, sleeping rough, but eventually we would reach civilization, inns, with food, and beds. I closed my eyes momentarily, envisioning the absolute bliss of a mattress. I didn't even aspire to a feather bed. Anything that promised more than an inch of padding between myself and the floor would be paradise. And of course, if it came with a modicum of privacy, even better. Jamie and I had not been completely celibate since December. Lust aside, and it wasn't, we needed the comfort and warmth of each other's body. Still, covert congress under a quilt with Rollo's yellow eyes fixed upon us from 2 feet away was less than ideal, even assuming that young Ian was invariably asleep, which I didn't think he was, though he was sufficiently tactful as to pretend. A hideous shriek split the air, and I jerked, dropping the basket. I flung myself after it, barely snatching the handle before it was whirled away on the flood, and stood up, dripping and trembling, heart hammering, as I waited to see whether the scream would be repeated. It was, followed in short order by an equally piercing screech, but one deeper in timbre, and recognisable to my well-trained ears as the sort of noise made by a Scottish Highlander suddenly immersed in freezing water. Fainter, higher-pitched shrieks, and a breathless "fuck," spoken in a Dorset accent, indicated that the gentlemen of the household were taking their spring bath. I wrung out the hem of my shift, and snatching my shawl from the branch where I left it, slipped on my shoes, and made my way in the direction of the bellowing. There are few things more enjoyable than sitting in relative warmth and comfort, while watching fellow human beings soused in cold water. If said human beings present a complete review of the nude male form, so much the better. I threaded my way through a small growth of fresh-budding river willows, found a conveniently screened rock in the sun, and spread out the damp skirt of my shift, enjoying the warmth on my shoulders, the sharp scent of the fuzzy catkins, and the sight before me. Jamie was standing in the pool, nearly shoulder deep, his hair slicked back like a russet seal. Bobby stood on the bank, and picking up Aidan with a grunt, threw him to Jamie in a pinwheel of flailing limbs and piercing shrieks of delighted fright.
Me, 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 me!
Ori was dancing around his stepfather's legs, his chubby bottom bouncing up and down among the reeds like a little pink balloon. Bobby laughed, bent, and hoisted him up, holding him for a moment high overhead as he squealed like a seared pig, then flung him in a shallow arc out over the pool. He hit the water with a tremendous splash, and Jamie grabbed him, laughing, and pulled him to the surface, where he emerged with a look of open-mouthed stupefaction that made them all hoot like gibbons. Aidan and Rollo were both dog-paddling round in circles by now, shouting and barking. I looked across to the opposite side of the pool and saw Ian rush naked down the small hill and leap like a salmon into the pool, uttering one of his best Mohawk war cries. This was cut off abruptly by the cold water, and he vanished with scarcely a splash. I waited, as did the others, for him to pop back up, but he didn't. Jamie looked suspiciously behind him in case of a sneak attack, but an instant later, Ian shot out of the water directly in front of Bobby with a blood-curdling yell, grabbed him by the leg and yanked him in. Matters thereafter became generally chaotic, with a great deal of promiscuous splashing, yelling, hooting and jumping off of rocks, which gave me the opportunity to reflect on just how delightful naked men are. Not that I hadn't seen a good many of them in my time, but aside from Frank and Jamie, most men I'd seen undressed usually had been either ill or injured, and were encountered in such circumstances as to prevent a leisurely appreciation of their finer attributes. From Ori's chubbiness and Aidan's spidery winter-white limbs to Bobby's skinny, pale torso and neat little flat behind, the McCullum Higginses were as entertaining to watch as a cageful of monkeys. Ian and Jamie were something different, baboons, perhaps, or mandrills. They didn't really resemble each other in any attribute other than height, and yet were plainly cut from the same cloth. Watching Jamie squatting on a rock above the pool, thighs tensing for a leap, I could easily see him preparing to attack a leopard, while Ian stretched himself glistening in the sun, warming his dangly bits while keeping an alert watch for intruders. All they needed were purple bottoms, and they could have walked straight onto the African veldt, no questions asked. They were all lovely, in their wildly various ways. But it was Jamie my gaze returned to, over and over again. He was battered and scarred, his muscles roped and knotted, and age had grooved the hollows between them. The thick welt of the bayonet scar writhed up his thigh, wide and ugly, while the thinner white line of the scar left by a rattlesnake's bite was nearly invisible, clouded by the thick fuzz of his body hair, this beginning to dry now, and stand out from his skin in a cloud of reddish gold. The scimitar-shaped sword cut across his ribs had healed well too, no more than a hair-thin white line by now. He turned round and bent to pick up a cake of soap from the rock, and my insides turned over. It wasn't purple, but could not otherwise have been improved on, being high, round, delicately dusted with red gold, and with a delightful muscular concavity to the sides. His balls, just visible from behind, were purple with the cold, and gave me a strong urge to creep up behind him and cup them in my rock-warmed hands. I wondered whether the resultant standing broad jump would enable him to clear the pool. I had not, in fact, seen him naked or even substantially undressed in several months. But now, I threw back my head, closing my eyes against the brilliant spring sun, enjoying the tickle of my own fresh-washed hair against my shoulder blades. The snow was gone, the weather was good, and the whole outdoors beckoned invitingly, filled with places where privacy could be assured, bar the odd skunk. I left the men dripping and sunning themselves on the rocks and went to retrieve my clothes. I didn't put these on, though. Instead, I went quickly up to the spring house where I submerged my basket of greens in the cool water. If I took it to the cabin, Amy would seize them and boil them into submission. And left my gown, stays, and stockings rolled up on the shelf where the cheeses were stacked. Then I went back toward the stream. The splashing and shouting had ceased. Instead, I heard low-voiced singing coming along the trail. It was Bobby, carrying Ori, sound asleep after his exertions. Aiden, groggy with cleanliness and warmth, ambled slowly beside his stepfather, dark head tilting to and fro to the rhythm of the song. It was a lovely Gaelic lullaby. Amy must have taught it to Bobby. I did wonder if she told him what the words meant. I smiled to see them, though with a catch in my throat. I remembered Jamie carrying Jem back from swimming the summer before, and Roger singing to Mandy in the night, his harsh, cracked voice little more than a whisper, but music all the same. I nodded to Bobby, who smiled and nodded back, though without interrupting his song. He raised his brows and jerked a thumb over his shoulder and uphill, presumably indicating where Jamie had gone. He betrayed no surprise at seeing me in shift and shawl. Doubtless he thought I was bound for the stream to wash as well, inspired by the singular warmth of the day. I waved briefly and turned up the side trail that led to the upper clearing. New house, everyone called it, though the only indications that there might someday be a house there were a stack of felled logs and a number of pegs driven into the ground with strings tied between them. These were meant to mark the placement and dimensions of the house Jamie intended to build in replacement of the big house, when we came back. He'd been moving the pegs, I saw. The wide front room was now wider, and the back room, intended for my surgery, had developed a growth of some sort, perhaps a separate still room. The architect was sitting on a log, surveying his kingdom, stark naked. "Expecting me, were you?" I asked, taking off my shawl and hanging it on a convenient branch.
"I was."
He smiled and scratched his chest.
"I thought the sight of my naked backside would likely inflame you. Or was it maybe Bobby's?"
"Bobby hasn't got one." "Do you know, you haven't got a single grey hair below the neck. Why is that, I wonder?" He glanced down, inspecting himself, but it was true. There were only a few strands of silver among the fiery mass of his hair, though his beard, the winter growth tediously and painfully removed a few days before, was heavily frosted with white. But the hair on his chest was still a dark auburn, and that below a fluffy mass of vivid ginger. He combed his fingers thoughtfully through the exuberant foliage, looking down.
"I think it's hiding," he remarked,
and glanced up at me, one eyebrow raised.
Want to come and help me hunt for it?
I came round in front of him and obligingly knelt down. The object in question was, in fact, quite visible, though admittedly looking rather shell-shocked by the recent immersion, and a most interesting shade of pale blue. Well, I said, after a moment's contemplation, great oaks from tiny acorns grow.
Oh, so I'm told.
A shiver ran through him at the warmth of my mouth, and I lifted my hands involuntarily, cradling his balls.
Holy God, he said,
and his hands rested lightly on my head in benediction.
What did you see?
He asked a moment later. I said, coming up momentarily for air, I find the goose flesh rather erotic.
There's more where that came from, he assured me. Take your shift off, Sassenach. I haven't seen you naked in nearly 4 months.
Well, no, you haven't, I agreed, hesitating. And I'm not sure I want you to. One eyebrow went up.
Why ever not?
Because I've been indoors for weeks on end without sun or exercise to speak of. I probably look like one of those grubs you find under rocks. Fat, white, and squidgy.
Squidgy?
He repeated, breaking into a grin. Squidgy, I said with dignity, wrapping my arms around myself. He pursed his lips and exhaled slowly, eyeing me with his head on one side.
I like it when you're fat, but I can quite well that you're not, he said, because I've felt your ribs when I put my arms about you each night since the end of January. As for white, you've been white all the time I've known you. It's no likely to come a great shock to me. As for the squidgy part,
he extended one hand and wiggled the fingers beckoningly at me.
I think I might enjoy that.
I said, still hesitant. He sighed.
Sassenach, he said. I said I haven't seen you naked in 4 months. That means if you take your shift off now, you'll be the best thing I've seen in 4 months. And at my age, I didn't think I remember farther back than that.
I laughed, and without further ado, stood up and pulled the ribbon tie at the neck of my shift. Wriggling, I let it fall in a puddle round my feet. He closed his eyes, then breathed deep and opened them again.
I'm blinded, he said softly,
and held out a hand to me.
Blinded as in sun bouncing off a vast expanse of snow? I asked dubiously. Or as in coming face to face with a gorgon?
Seeing a gorgon turns you to stone, not strikes you blind, he informed me. Though, come to think,
he prodded himself with an experimental forefinger.
I may turn to stone yet. Will you come here for God's sake?
I came. I fell asleep in the warmth of Jamie's body, and woke some time later, snugly wrapped in his plaid. I stretched, alarming a squirrel overhead who ran out on a limb to get a better view. Evidently he didn't like what he saw, and began scolding and chattering.
Oh, hush, I said, yawning, and sat up.
The squirrel took exception to this gesture and began having hysterics, but I ignored him. To my surprise, Jamie was gone. I thought he'd likely just stepped into the wood to relieve himself, but a quick glance round didn't discover him, and when I scrambled to my feet, the plaid clutched to me, I saw no sign of him. I hadn't heard anything. Surely if someone had come, I would have wakened, or Jamie would have wakened me. I listened carefully, but the squirrel, having now gone about its own business, heard nothing beyond the normal sounds of a forest waking to spring, the murmur and rush of wind through new-leafed trees, punctuated by the occasional crack of a falling branch, or the rattle of last year's pine cones and chestnut hulls bouncing through the canopy, the call of a distant jay, The conversation of a gang of pygmy nuthatches foraging in the long grass nearby, the rustle of a hungry vole in the winter's dead leaves. The jay was still calling. Another had joined it now, shrill with alarm. Perhaps that was where Jamie had gone. I unwound myself from the plaid and pulled on my shift and shoes. It was getting on for evening. We, or I at least, had slept a long time. It was still warm in the sun, but the shadows under the trees were cold, and I put on my shawl and bundled up Jamie's plaid into my arms. Likely he'd want it. I followed the calling of the jays uphill, away from the clearing. There was a pair nesting near the white spring. I'd seen them building the nest only 2 days before. It wasn't far from the house site at all, though that particular spring always had the air of being remote from everything. It lay in the centre of a small grove of white ash and hemlock, and was shielded on the east by a jagged outcropping of lichen-covered rock. All water has a sense of life about it, and a mountain spring carries a particular sense of quiet joy, rising pure from the heart of the earth. The white spring, so called for the big pale boulder that stood guardian over its pool, had something more, a sense of inviolate peace. The closer I came to it, the surer I was that that was where I'd find Jamie.
There's something there that listens, he'd told Brianna once, quite casually. You see such pools in the Highlands. They're called saints' pools. Folk say the saint lives by the pool and listens to their prayers.
And what saint lives by the white spring? She'd asked, cynical. Saint Killian?
Why him?
Patron saint of gout, rheumatism and whitewashers. He'd laughed at that, shaking his head.
Whatever it is that lives in such water is older than the notion of saints, he assured her. But it listens.
I walked softly, approaching the spring. The jays had fallen silent now. He was there, sitting on a rock by the water, wearing only his shirt. I saw why the jays had gone about their business. He was still as the white boulder itself, his eyes closed, hands turned upward on his knees, loosely cupped, inviting grace. I stopped at once when I saw him. I'd seen him pray here once before when he'd asked Dougal Mackenzie for help in battle. I didn't know who he was talking to just now, but it wasn't a conversation I wished to intrude upon. I ought to leave, I supposed. But aside from the fear that I might disturb him by an inadvertent noise, I didn't want to go. Most of the spring lay in shadow, but fingers of light came down through the trees, stroking him. The air was thick with pollen, and the light was filled with motes of gold. It struck answering glints from the crown of his head, the smooth high arch of his foot, the blade of his nose, the bones of his face. He might have grown there, part of earth and stone and water, might have been himself the spirit of the spring. I didn't feel unwelcome. The peace of the place reached out to touch me, gently, slow my heart. Was that what he sought here, I wondered? Was he drawing the peace of the mountain into himself, to remember, to sustain him during the months, the years, perhaps, of coming exile? I would remember. The light began to go, brightness falling from the air. He stirred finally, lifting his head a little.
Let me be enough, he said quietly.
I started at the sound of his voice, but he hadn't been speaking to me. He opened his eyes and rose then, quiet as he'd sat, and came past the stream, long feet bare and silent on the layers of damp leaves. As he came past the outcropping of rock, he saw me and smiled, reaching out to take the plaid I held out to him, wordless. He said nothing, but took my cold hand in his large, warm one, and we turned toward home, walking together in the mountain's peace. A few days later, he came to find me. I was foraging along the creek bank for leeches, which had begun to emerge from their winter's hibernation, ravenous for blood. They were simple to catch. I merely waded slowly through the water near shore. At first, the thought of acting as live bait for the leeches was repellent, but after all, that was how I usually obtained leeches, by letting Jamie, Ian, Bobby, or any of a dozen young males wade through the streams and pick them off. And once you got used to the sight of the creatures slowly engorging with your blood, it wasn't all that bad. I have to let them have enough blood to sustain themselves, I explained, grimacing as I eased a thumbnail under the sucker of a leech in order to dislodge it. But not enough that they'll be comatose, or they won't be of any use.
A matter of nice judgment, Jamie agreed as I dropped the leech into a jar filled with water and duckweed. When you've done feeding your wee pets, then, come along and I'll show you the Spaniard's cave.
It was no little distance, perhaps 4 miles from the ridge, through cold, muddy creeks and up steep slopes, then through a crack in a granite cliff face that made me feel as though I were being entombed alive, only to emerge into a wilderness of jutting boulders smothered in nets of wild grape.
We found it, Jem and I, out hunting one day, Jamie explained, lifting a curtain of leaves for me to pass beneath.
The vines snaked over the rocks, thick as a man's forearm and knotted with age, the rusty green leaves of spring not yet quite covering them.
It was a secret between us. We agreed we'd tell no one else, not even his parents.
Nor me, I said, but wasn't offended. I heard the loss in his voice at the mention of Jem. The entrance to the cave was a crack in the ground over which Jamie had pushed a large flat rock. He slid this back with some effort, and I bent over cautiously, experiencing a brief clench of the innards at the faint sound of moving air through the fissure. The surface air was warm, though. The cave was drawing, not blowing. I remembered all too well the cave at Abandor that had seemed to breathe around us, and it took some force of will to follow Jamie as he disappeared into the earth. There was a rough wooden ladder, new, I saw, but replacing a much older one that had fallen to pieces. Some bits of rotted wood were still in place, dangling from the rock on rusted iron spikes. It could have been no more than 10 or 12 feet to the bottom, but the neck of the cave was narrow, and the descent seemed endless. At last I reached the bottom, though, and saw that the cave had opened out like the bottom of a flask. Jamie was crouched to one side. I saw him draw out a small bottle and smelled the sharp scent of turpentine. He'd brought a torch, a pine knot with a head dipped in tar and wrapped with a rag. He soaked the rag with turpentine, then drew the fire starter Bree had made for him. A shower of sparks lit his face, intent and ruddy. Twice more, and the torch caught, the flame bursting through the flammable cloth and catching the tar. He lifted the torch and gestured toward the floor behind me. I turned and nearly jumped out of my skin. The Spaniard leaned against the wall, bony legs stretched out, skull fallen forward as if in a doze. Tufts of reddish, faded hair still clung here and there, but the skin had gone entirely. His hands and feet were mostly gone, too, the small bones carried away by rodents. No large animals had been able to get at him, though, and while the torso and long bones showed signs of nibbling, they were largely intact. The swell of the rib cage poked through a tissue of cloth so faded that there was no telling what colour it had ever been. He was a Spaniard, too. A crested metal helmet, red with rust, lay by him, along with an iron breastplate and a knife.
Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ, I whispered.
Jamie crossed himself and knelt by the skeleton.
I've no notion how long he's been here, he said, also low-voiced. We didn't find anything with him, save the armour. And that.
He pointed to the gravel just in front of the pelvis. I leaned closer to look. A small crucifix, probably silver, now tarnished black. And a few inches away, a tiny triangular shape, also black. A rosary? I asked, and Jamie nodded.
I expect he was wearing it about his neck. It must have been made of wood and string, and when it rotted, the metal bits fell. That,
his finger gently touched the little triangle, says
N-R-S-R-A-A-N-G. On the one side, Nuestra Señora de los Ángeles. I think it means Our Lady of the Angels. There's a wee picture of the Blessed Virgin on the other side.
I crossed myself by reflex.
Was Jemmy scared?
I asked, after a moment's respectful silence.
I was, Jamie said dryly. It was dark when I came down the shaft, and I nearly stepped on this fellow. I thought he was alive, and the shock of it liked to stop my heart.
He'd cried out in alarm, and Jemmy, left above ground with strict instructions not to move from the spot, had promptly scrambled into the hole, losing his grip of the broken ladder halfway down, and landing feet first on his grandfather.
I heard him scrabbling and looked up, just in time to have him plunge out of the heavens and strike me in the breast like a cannonball.
Jamie rubbed the left side of his chest with rueful amusement.
If I hadn't looked up, he'd have broken my neck. And he'd never have got out by himself.
And we'd never have known what happened to either one of you. I swallowed, dry-mouthed at the thought. And yet, on any given day, something just as random might happen. To anyone.
I wonder neither of you broke anything, I said instead,
and gestured toward the skeleton. What do you think happened to this gentleman?
His people never knew.
Jamie shook his head.
I dinna ken. He wasna expecting an enemy because he wasna wearing his armour.
You don't think he fell in and couldn't get out?
I squatted by the skeleton, tracing the tibia of the left leg. The bone was dried and cracked, gnawed at the end by small, sharp teeth. But I could see what might be a greenstick fracture of the bone, or might just be the cracking of age. Jamie shrugged, glancing up.
I shouldn't have think so. He was a good bit shorter than I am, but I think the original ladder must have been here when he died. For if someone built the ladder later, why would they leave this gentleman here at the bottom of it? And even with a broken leg, he should have been able to climb it.
He might have died of a fever, I suppose. That would account for his taking off his breastplate and helmet. Though I, personally, would have taken them off at the first opportunity. Depending on the season, he must either have been boiled alive or suffered severely from mildew, semi-enclosed in metal. I glanced up at this sound, which indicated dubious acceptance of my reasoning, while indicating disagreement with my conclusion. You think he was killed? He shrugged.
He has armour, but nae weapon save a wee knife. And you can see he was right-handed, but the knife's lying to his left.
The skeleton had been right-handed. The bones of the right arm were noticeably thicker, even by the flicker of torchlight. Possibly a swordsman? I wondered.
I kent a good many Spanish soldiers in the Indies, Sassenach. All of them fair bristled with swords and spears and pistols. If this man died of a fever, his companions might take his arms. But they'd take the armour too, and the knife. Why leave it?
But by that token, I objected, why did whoever killed him, if he was killed, leave the armour and the knife?
As for the armour, they didn't want it. It wouldn't be particularly useful to anyone other than the soldier. As for the knife, because it was sticking in him, Jamie suggested, and it's no a very good knife to begin with.
Very logical, I said, swallowing again. Putting aside the question of how he died, What in God's name was he doing in the mountains of North Carolina in the first place?
The Spanish sent explorers up as far as Virginia 50 or 60 years ago, he informed me. The swamps discouraged them, though.
I can see why. But why this? I stood up, waving a hand to encompass the cave and its ladder. He didn't reply, but took my arm and lifted his torch, turning me to the side of the cave opposite the ladder. Well above my head, I saw another small fissure in the rock, black in the torchlight, barely wide enough for a man to wriggle through.
There's a smaller cave through there, he said, nodding upward. And when I put Jem up to look, he told me there were marks in the dust, square marks, as though heavy boxes had sat there.
Which is why, when the need to hide treasure had occurred to him, so had thought of the Spaniard's cave.
We'll bring the last of the gold tonight, he said, and pile rocks to hide the opening up there. Then we'll leave the Señor here to his rest.
I was obliged to admit that the cave made as suitable a resting place as any, and the Spanish soldier's presence would likely discourage anyone who stumbled on the cave from further investigation, both Indians and settlers having a distinct aversion to ghosts. For that matter, so did Highlanders. And I turned curiously to Jamie. You and Jem, you weren't troubled about being haunted by him?
Nay. We said the proper prayer for the repose of his soul when I sealed the cave and scattered salt around it.
That made me smile. You know the proper prayer for every occasion, don't you? He smiled faintly in return and rubbed the head of the torch in the damp gravel to extinguish it. A faint shaft of light from above glowed on the crown of his head.
There's always a prayer, Anian, even if it's only a year. Kudishmi. Oh God, help me.
Chapter 9. A Knife That Knows My Hand. Not all the gold rested with the Spaniard. Two of my petticoats had an extra turn-up in the hem, with shavings of gold evenly distributed in tiny pockets. And my large pocket itself had several ounces of gold stitched into the seam at the bottom. Jamie and Ian each carried a small amount in his sporran, and each of them would carry two substantial shot pouches on his belt. We had retired, the three of us, to the new house clearing to make the shot in private.
Now, you'll no forget which side to load from, eh?
Jamie dropped a fresh musket ball out of the mould, glowing like a miniature sunrise into the pot of grease and soot.
As long as you dinna take my shot bag in mistake, no, Ian said caustically.
He was making lead shot, dropping the hot, fresh balls into a hollow lined with moist leaves, where they smoked and steamed in the crisp spring evening. Rollo, lying nearby, sneezed as a wisp of smoke drifted past his nose and snorted explosively. Ian glanced at him with a smile.
"Will you like chasing the red deer through the heather, Aku?" he asked. "You'll need to keep off the sheep, though, or someone's like to shoot you for a wolf."
Rollo sighed and let his eyes go to drowsy slits.
"Thinking what you'll say to your mam when you see her?"
Jamie asked, squinting against the smoke of the fire as he held the ladle of gold shavings over the flame.
"Try not to think too much," Ian replied frankly. "I get a queer feeling in my weem when I think of Lallybroch."
"Good queer or bad queer?" I asked, gingerly scooping the cooled gold balls out of the grease with a wooden spoon and dropping them into the shot pouches. Ian frowned, eyes fixed on his ladle as the lead went suddenly from crumpled blobs to a quivering puddle.
"Both, I think. Brianna told me once about a book she'd read in school that said, you can't go home again. I think that's maybe true. But I want to," he added softly, eyes still on his work.
The melted lead hissed into the mould. I looked away from the wistfulness in his face and found Jamie looking at me, his gaze quizzical, eyes soft with sympathy. I looked away from him too, and rose to my feet, groaning slightly as my knee joint cracked.
Yes, well, I said briskly, I suppose it depends on what you think home is, doesn't it? It isn't always a place, you know.
Aye, that's true.
Ian held the bullet mould for an instant, letting it cool. But even when it's a person, you can't always go back, aye?
Or maybe you can,
he added, his mouth quirking a little as he glanced up at Jamie and then at me.
I think you'll find your parents much as you left them,
Jamie said dryly, choosing to ignore Ian's reference.
You may come as a greater shock to them.
Ian glanced down at himself and smiled.
Got a bit taller, he said.
I gave a brief snort of amusement. He'd been 15 when he'd left Scotland, a tall, scrawny gawk of a boy. He was a couple of inches taller now. He was also lean and hard as a strip of dried rawhide, and normally tanned to much the same colour, though the winter had bleached him, making the tattooed dots that ran in semicircles across his cheekbones stand out more vividly.